Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. It is Friday, so let's get to the docket. First, there was a hearing today. Will, Lori, and Chad have separate trials. Next, Chandler Halderson showed up for his sentencing. Anna Delvey, she's so poor. Is Ron Jeremy competent? We'll talk about that horrific Texas crash. An example of why you don't mess with mom. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. You are going to want to wait around for this one. Let's talk about it. Good day, aficionados. This is Crime Talk. My name is Scott Reich. Thanks for watching. Today is Friday, March 18th, 2022. But you know the drill. Before we can open the docket, we need to take care of a couple of things. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe button. Hit that little bell so you receive those notifications. Always leave us a comment below. And remember, you can listen to us by downloading Crime Talk on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Now, before we do open the docket, let's have a quick word from today's sponsor. Like many Americans, we got a dog during the pandemic. My quarantine dog, Miss Winnie the Bulldog. Now, Miss Winnie has grown accustomed to being around us all the time. When we were leaving the house, Winnie would have extreme anxiety, so we decided to look for natural products to help with her anxiety. We looked for the highest quality CBD treats, and we were not satisfied, and neither was Winnie. So we created a high-quality CBD product that absorbs faster and provides the required results faster. Baked in Colorado, CBD treats and beverage enhancers are made with nanotechnology. The nanotechnology makes the CBD extraction more pure, also allows for Baked in Colorado products to work faster. Baked in Colorado products can help reduce your pet's anxiety, ease joint pain, and help with your dog's skin problems. Go to our online store and see what Baked in Colorado product is best for your dog. When you order at bakedincolorado.com, enter code Winnie and receive 15% off your first order. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee. If your dog does not experience the desired results in 30 days, return the product and we will refund your money. No questions asked. Okay, let's open the docket for Friday, March 18th, 2022. There was a hearing held today in regards to Chad DeBell's motion for severance. Severance from what, Scott? Severance from having the same trial with Lori Vallow. Well, that's kind of a factual and legal impossibility at this point. Well, why is that? Well, because Lori Vallow is still at the state hospital being restored to competency. And it was somewhat alluded to today at the hearing that it doesn't appear as though there's been any change as it relates to Lori Vallow, with one exception that I'll get to in just a minute. Okay, so Mr. Pryor, Chad DeBell's attorney, has filed a motion some 5 months ago, and the court said, no, we're going to have a hearing today. Even though the prosecution wanted to delay the hearing, the court said, no, we're going to go forward because these matters need to be resolved for everybody involved. And the motion is severance. As you may recall, in the indictment, Lori Vallow, Chad DeBell, are charged with conspiracy regarding the deaths of J.J. Tiley, as well as Tammy, who was Chad DeBell's wife before she passed away and married Lori Vallow several days after her death. Nothing weird about that, for sure, right? Well, anyway, so normally when there is an indictment and there are co-conspirators, the trial goes together. They all go to trial together. The court has blocked out some 10 weeks for this trial, and the trial is not scheduled to commence until January of 2023. But really, I know it seems like a long time, but from the attorney's perspective, that's just right around the corner because there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So Mr. Pryor is trying to find out as much information as he can as to what is the evidence that is going to be presented against his client, like any attorney would do. Mr. Pryor is saying, we need a decision because Chad DeBell is in custody and we cannot wait indefinitely for Lori Vallow to be restored to competency if and when she ever would be. And that makes complete sense. The prosecution says, well, he signed a waiver of speedy trial, so you know, there's not a big issue. Now, normally in state courts, when you sign a waiver of speedy trial, it usually means a six-month period begins from a particular date. From the date that you sign it, that's the new six-month period begins. Now, Chad DeBell signed a waiver of speedy trial. I took it to mean that it was from 6 months from that date, but they agreed to set the trial date out into January of 2023 because it is a death penalty case and it does require a lot more work. But it doesn't mean that you indefinitely waive your right to a speedy trial. You know, that pesky little thing in the Constitution that says you have a right to a speedy trial, a public trial, because, you know, we didn't like it when the king said, we're going to throw you in jail and we'll get around to a trial when we think it's okay or when it's convenient for us. And that was really the argument of the prosecution today. The prosecutor kept saying, and I don't know how many times she said it, but she said it a lot, which was judicial economy. What does that word really mean? Judicial economy means, judge, it's going to be really expensive and inconvenient for us to do this case multiple times. Please don't make us do this case more than once. That's basically the government's argument. Judge, just doesn't make sense. Why we should have to do this twice? Because it's the same evidence and it's just not fair to us. And it's going to be really expensive. Did we mention that, Judge? Really expensive. And it's going to take up a lot of time in your docket too. That is judicial economy. It's certainly a factor that the court has to consider when ruling on a motion for severance, but there's two more important issues here. Judicial economy is certainly a factor that the court must consider in making their decision, but there are other factors that the court also needs to consider. First, are there any Bruton issues? This came up during the hearing, and you can watch the hearing at the link below. So one of the things the court has to consider is whether there is a Bruton issue. And this is a case from the United States Supreme Court that goes back to 1968. And in that case, and let's make sure we get it all correct here, it was a joint trial between co-defendants. And one of the co-defendants was convicted of both armed postal robbery. Now, one of the defendants did not take the stand, but a postal inspector testified that the one defendant confessed orally and that Mr. Bruton and the petitioner committed the robbery. The trial judge instructed the jury that although Evans' confession was competent evidence against him, it was inadmissible hearsay against Mr. Bruton and had to be disregarded in determining petitioner's guilt or innocence. Well, needless to say, co-defendant and Mr. Bruton both appealed to the Court of Appeals. The court set aside Evans' conviction on the ground that the oral confession should not have been received against him, but affirmed petitioner's conviction in view of the trial judge's instruction. Well, the Supreme Court said, because of the substantial risk that the jury, despite the instruction to the contrary, looked to the incriminating extrajudicial statements in determining petitioner's guilt, admission of the other co-defendant's confession in the joint trial violated Mr. Bruton's right of cross-examination secured by the Confrontation Clause of the United States Constitution, specifically the Sixth Amendment. That Confrontation Clause keeps coming up, doesn't it? Because it's a huge thing when it comes to court. And so you can't cross-examine what somebody else said when you allow in hearsay testimony saying that person confessed. You can't do that. So normally what happens when you have co-conspirator statements being admissible in court, you have to do a proffer. And it usually comes up in federal court because it really makes the federal prosecutors work. And at the hearing today, the prosecutor's like, Judge, we can't go through and look at every statement we want to use. That would just take up too much time. Wah! You're the prosecutor. You have all the resources. Go do the work. I do not understand why these prosecutors are hesitant to go to trial. It really makes me wonder if they think they don't have enough to convict. And so when you have a proffer of Bruton statements, the prosecutors have to say, here's the statement that I want to use. Here is why it is admissible. So what rule of evidence it's going to be admissible under, what exception, because it's a hearsay statement. And then you have to say what witness you're going to bring it in and under what theory. Is the statement made in furtherance of the conspiracy? Was it after the conspiracy? There's lots of different things. And so It is very important for the court to determine what statements are admissible pre-trial so that you don't have a mistrial. Bottom line. The other thing is inconsistent theories of defenses. That's another reason the court has to consider. Is there an inconsistent theory of defense that basically you're going to point fingers at each other? Well, that in and of itself, as the prosecutor said, isn't necessarily enough of a reason to do that, particularly when you have a third party that could be involved. Here we have Alex Cox, who is basically listed as an unindicted co-conspirator and more than likely committed these murders. So you can point the fingers at yourself as well as to a third party, which the defense will more than likely do as it relates to Alex Cox. So that's another reason why the prosecution says, don't worry about it. They're just going to point their finger at Alex Cox. They didn't mention his name, but they mentioned a third party. Now, here is something that I think is rather significant that came from the prosecutor today. When they were discussing Bruton issues, she says, Judge, we don't anticipate any statements. And I'm not really sure the district attorney truly understands Bruton statements. Yes, there are confessions, but are they statements in furtherance of the conspiracy, or when did they come? And she stated, the prosecutor stated, Judge, there are no Bruton issues that we are aware of. Basically, statements that can be used against one co-defendant and not the other, just like we had in the Bruton case, right? But she said that is evolving. She said that specifically at 31 minutes and 53 seconds into our playing of the hearing today. Now, what does that make me think? That maybe some of those statements that are being given by Lori Vallow while at the state hospital are coming in and could potentially be used against Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow, assuming Lori Vallow can actually come to court. So it's rather interesting, the turn of events. The judge sat on this motion for 5 months now. He needs to make a decision soon. I agree with Mr. Pryor. Chad Daybell has a right to a speedy trial. It's a lot different in the federal court system where you basically the speedy trial doesn't start until the last co-defendant comes in. Usually not the case when it comes to state court cases. And we can't wait to see if and when Lori Vallow is ever restored to competency. So what does that mean? Well, I think judicial economy falls in the favor of the prosecution. It makes sense to only have to do the case once. If there are no Bruton issues, well, that shouldn't be an issue. Antagonistic defenses, if Lori Vallow's not there, that's the issue. The real issue comes down to speedy trial. If the judge doesn't give Mr. Daybell a trial within a reasonable time under the Speedy Trial Act, which is usually 6 months in most state jurisdictions, the case could ultimately be dismissed based upon a violation of speedy trial. I think that's going to be the court's concern, and I think that Chad Daybell's trial is going to go in January of 2023, and we'll see if Lori Vallow makes it, but somehow I think, and she's not, the case is going to go forward. That's my gut instinct. We'll see if I got it right or if I crash and burn terribly. Only time will tell, but normally some of my predictions come true. Let's just wait and see. All right, next on the docket, Chandler Howlerson. Remember that guy? You know, maybe did some terrible things to his parents, maybe disposed of them through various parts of Wisconsin and maybe burned them a little bit in the, you know, fireplace at home, that kind of stuff. He didn't want to come to court for his sentencing. Well, guess what? He showed up. And a Wisconsin judge has sentenced Chandler to life in prison without any opportunity for extended supervision. That's a fancy word for parole. Now, just 24 days ago, a jury convicted Mr. Halderson of 2 counts of first-degree intentional homicide, 2 counts of providing false information regarding a kidnapped or missing person, 2 counts of mutilating a corpse, and 2 counts of hiding a corpse, 1 count for each of his parents. Now, trial prosecutors said that Mr. Halderson lied to his parents about working for a local insurance company and with a local rescue dive team while he was really living at home and playing video games during the day. Sounds like a real ball of fire. He even told his girlfriend he secured a job with Elon Musk's SpaceX. When his lies caught up with him, a jury agreed with the prosecutors that Mr. Halderson shot his father, Bart Halderson, in the back. He then killed his mother, Krista Halderson, when she returned home. And during sentencing, prosecutors Andrea Raymond said the case presented at her office with not your average pre-sentence investigation report. Chandler Halderson was very privileged growing up. There was no evidence of abuse. His parents were happily married and supported him. He was never exposed to any violence and never had to worry where his next meal was coming from. I agree with the prosecutor. That's usually what you see in pre-sentence investigation reports of people in the criminal justice system. Now, perhaps his mother babied him too much and was a little too doting. I took a lot of heat when I said that. There was a little too much mommy, but even the prosecutor agrees with me. Well, needless to say, the prosecutor continued, it is out of this life of privilege, this childhood that was nearly ideal, that he committed these crimes. It is also worth noting that these crimes were committed against these two individuals that provided this childhood for him. The two people that took care of him, she also noted that Chandler never mourned his parents. Raymond said relatives would spend their lives questioning whether they missed red flags or could have done anything to save the victim from their untimely fates. Well, the defense attorney, Crystal Vera, attempted to stress to the judge that Mr. Halderson was redeemable and deserved a chance at parole. Now, Mr. Halderson made a brief statement in a monotone, almost robotic voice. Your Honor, I want to take the opportunity to state my intent to appeal my convictions. If there are any lawyers listening and willing to take on my appeal, take a moment to please reach out to me. I did not do that. I did not have feelings. It's that I was warned not to show them due to the scrutiny of the case. Thank you. That's basically code for my lawyer did a terrible job. Someone please help me for free. Well, the judge, Judge Hyland, then said that he needs to protect the public, and that was more important than the reconstruction of the Halderson family. He encouraged individual family members to decide for themselves whether it was appropriate to reconnect with the defendant behind prison walls. The judge appeared to struggle to hold back his own emotions when pondering the viciousness of the crime. The judge stated, "My condolences go out to every member of their family." Tough case, Mr. Halderson. Like I said, I took a lot of heat when I said, boy, it sounds like a little too much mommy, TMM. At least the prosecutor agreed with me on that one. Because that's clearly the guy's MO. He just took and took and took and didn't like it when somebody said, oh, I think it's time to grow up and get a job. Be careful out there, ladies and gentlemen. Be careful. Next on the docket, Anna Delvey, the one who the movie from Netflix creating or inventing Anna was based upon. Anna Delvey, she's got that scene where she's like, you're so poor. I'd love that. Well, anyway, the fake heiress, Anna Sorkin, has finally expressed remorse for her scam, saying that no money in the world is worth going to jail, even for one day. Now, Ms. Sorkin, who's now 31, who is the real-life inspiration for the Netflix show Inventing Anna, is currently behind bars trying to fight deportation. She states, I admit I've made some mistakes. I would say so, yeah. And she also says that she never tried to harm anybody, and she's trying to fix all those things right now. I don't know what that makes me. Now, Ms. Sorkin also goes by the name made up by Anna Delvey, where she allegedly conned friends, banks, and hotels by pretending to be a German heiress with a trust fund of some $60 million. Now, for the longest time, Anna maintained her innocence and said she never told anyone that she was a German heiress. They came to the conclusions on their own. When asked back in 2019 during her trial whether she had any regrets, she told a journalist, I'd be lying to you and to everyone else and to myself if I said I was sorry for anything. So in 2019, Ms. Sorkin was jailed for between 4 and 15 years in order to pay $199,000 in restitution to her many victims. She was ultimately released, and now Ms. Sorkin has appealed her deportation and is hoping to learn her fate in the next week. Now, Anna offered up this piece of wisdom in her most recent interview. You don't get to press a reset button and go back and fix what you've done in the past. So don't commit any crimes, and then you don't go to jail. it's definitely not worth it. Now, Ms. Sorkin claimed that she has settled her restitution and covers her own legal bills thanks to the $320,000 windfall that she received from Netflix. She is currently being held at the ICE custody at the Orange County Correctional Facility in Goshen, New York, for overstaying her visa. In an Instagram post, Ms. Sorkin compared her experience at Rikers Island to a luxury Moroccan villa when compared to the experience at the ICE detention facility. On Thursday, an ICE spokesman confirmed in November of 2021, the Board of Immigration Appeals granted Sorkin's emergency stay request. She remained in ICE custody pending removal. We'll see what happens. I don't think that's the last we're going to hear from Anna, whether it's here or in another country. Probably like the Tinder swindler guy who's now out there making tons of money, even though he's a total con man. Well, Ron Jeremy. It's been a while since we talked about Mr. Jeremy. As you may recall, he's had some legal troubles. Well, everything's been put on stay. Let me tell you why. His trial for the alleged sexual assaults, where it's alleged that Ron Jeremy was the perpetrator, was suspended yesterday after he appeared incoherent and confused in his cell at a California courthouse. The 68-year-old was supposed to go to trial in 2 weeks amid allegations that he had allegedly sexually assaulted some 24 women. However, Jeremy's attorney said yesterday that his client was non-responsive and did not recognize his lawyer. In 2020, charges were brought against Mr. Ron Jeremy, where prosecutors alleged he sexually assaulted 4 women in bars along the Sunset Strip. A more intensive investigation uncovered some 30 additional allegations and incidents going back to the year 2000. Now, the criminal charges against Mr. Jeremy stem from these allegations by 21 different women. And in February, Jeremy's legal team asked for his case to be separated into 21 separate trials. The Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge George Lomelli halted the criminal case and scheduled a mental competency evaluation and a hearing set now for April 1st. A follow-up hearing in regards to Jeremy's criminal case is also scheduled for April 19th. Maybe somebody was having a really bad day, and that's why he was incoherent. Or just coming to the realization that he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison. That can be shocking to some people. All right, next on the docket, let's talk about that Texas crash. This is why 13-year-olds don't drive. Okay, a 13-year-old Mennonite boy was driving a truck that veered into a bus full of University of Southwest golfers, killing himself, his father, and 6 of the students and their coach. Ricky Siemens was 13, and his father, Heinrich Siemens, 38, were among the people who died in Tuesday's crash in Andrews, Texas. A friend of the family revealed that Ricky had accidentally burned down his family's home in December of last year, completely destroying the property. The child was apparently driving the family's Dodge truck when the front left tire, a spare, blew out as it was hurtled down the flat Texas road at a high rate of speed, causing it to cross the line into oncoming traffic and slamming into the bus. 2 male students were pulled from the wreckage of Tuesday's crash alive and airlifted to the hospital. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board has not offered further information on why the boy was driving. The legal driving age in Texas, where the fatal accident took place, is 16 years of age. Family members, friends, and others who knew the 6 athletes killed in Tuesday's accident remembered them as great kids and community members as tributes continue to pour into the college regarding the golfers. 8 of the 9 people killed in the crash have been named by officials investigating the tragedy. The victims include 6 members of the University of Southwest men's and women's golf team, as well as their 26-year-old coach. So the victims are students: Lacey Stone, 18, Carissa Rains, 21, Mauricio Sanchez, 19, from Mexico, Travis Garcia, 19, of Pleasance in Texas, Jackson Zinn, 22, from Westminster, Colorado, and Tiago Souza, 18, of Portugal, all died, and the University of Southwest golf coach Tyler James, 26 years old, also passed away. It's a tragedy. Listen, this is why we don't have 13-year-olds out there. And if it was a spare tire, maybe there's nothing anybody could have done, but maybe somebody with a little more experience could have prevented the accident. That's why we don't let 13-year-olds drive, ladies and gentlemen. Tough case. All right, next on the docket. Don't mess with mom. A woman in Tigard, Oregon, teamed up with her neighbors to come to the rescue of her son after he was abducted from outside their apartment complex. The boy's mother told officers she had been inside her apartment watching her son play outside when she witnessed a man grab the 7-year-old. According to police, she told officers she then saw the man take her son into his own apartment where the door was then locked. Police say the mother and several other neighbors ran over to the apartment and proceeded to kick down the door in an attempt to rescue her son. The alleged kidnapper escaped out the back door and let the child go. Police have identified the suspect as 56-year-old James Harmon II. He was taken into police custody by the Washington and is being held at the Washington County Jail and has been charged with first-degree kidnapping. If guilty, Mr. Harmon will face a mandatory minimum sentence of 7 years and 6 months in prison, and Mr. Harmon is now set to remain in custody pending arraignment. Investigators have evidence which they think prove Mr. Harmon intended to harm the boy. You think? Of course he did. You don't abduct a 7-year-old and take him into your apartment to cook them dinner. He was going to have bad things done to him, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get for real here. Jeez. They say that additional charges may be pending, and now the Tigard police praise the quick actions and watchful eye of the boy's mother and her neighbors in preventing a more serious crime. Hats off to mom, okay? This is what I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen. You got to take care of yourself. You got to be able to take care of your family. Waiting for the police, the bad things may have already happened. You have to be prepared. Good job to mom. Now, obviously, Mr. Harmon will give you the presumption of innocence. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We know exactly what you were thinking, Mr. Harmon. You sicko. That's right. All right. All right, next on the docket, our dumb criminal of the day, which is going to be great, but we got to go through a recap quickly of the dumb contestants throughout the week. First, a Florida man by the name of Thomas Eugene Colucci called the police and asked them to come test his meth after he feared he may have been sold bath salts. Well, it turned out it was in fact meth, whereupon he was promptly arrested. Tuesday, from her mobile home, Renee Bolduc took a water gun and squirted Nicole Hosmer in the face because she was upset that she was walking down her street. That's still an assault, ladies and gentlemen, even if it's just water. Wednesday, Kathy Kidd was charged with battery, and in her mugshot, she is seen wearing a dumb, D-U-M-B shirt, which apparently to her stands for Don't Underestimate My Brain. Oh, no, we do not. We do not. Thursday, police pulled over Antonio Stanley, and when they searched his car, they found a large amount of marijuana, THC wax, and individually wrapped Freestone pickle. That's right. Who knew? Pickles. And today, who do we have? Well, we have Hunter Biden. Yes, that's right. The son of the president of the United States. Now, we understand that Hunter Biden's had some issues over the years. He was kicked out of the Navy for drug use. It can happen to anybody. Drugs do not discriminate. But he's had a little extended experience with lots of drugs by his own admissions in his own book. But then what does he do when he's on a total crack binger? But when he somehow water soaks his laptop computer, he takes it to a local repair shop and never picks it up. And then ultimately it becomes the property of the computer repair store, and they look into it to see what's on their new computer. And it turns out to be lots of emails regarding shady deals involving Hunter Biden and other people, and oh, possibly the big guy, aka Joe Biden, because he's got to make sure he gets his piece. And when that story first came out, I said, wow, this could really be a big story. This is not good for the Hunter Biden. He could be a dumb criminal contestant. And everybody said, oh, Scott, oh my gosh, Scott, what are you, some sort of Russian operative? Is that all you're doing, spreading misinformation? I said, no, I think it's a legitimate story because they'd already talked to people that had corroborated it. Well, although many other news sources have corroborated it, finally, that's right, the official paper for America, the New York Times, has finally said that that laptop that was dropped off at the computer repair store and not picked up by Hunter Biden was Hunter Biden's because they've been able to corroborate that those emails were his by talking to the other people on the other end of the email and confirming that. Yes. And in other news, it also appears as though Hunter Biden may be indicted for tax evasion based upon the word of his baby mama stripper. Her attorney says that she testified before the grand jury, but they couldn't discuss anything further other than they believe that he will in fact be indicted. And where's some of that evidence coming from? The computer. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, the computer. Hunter Biden, you, although we'll give you the presumption of innocence, are our dumb criminal of the day. All right, thanks for watching. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.